About a year and a half after Mira's birth, when she finally started sleeping through the night, I started to emerge from the deep, consuming fog of anxiety that had enveloped me through her babyhood. After she was born, I was engaged in a balancing act of survival, so afraid to look down that I took in only as much information as was offered. As I started to come back to myself, to the new landscape that was our family, I had a question. What happened? For us, as for many families, there is no answer to that question. No one knows why the placenta failed. The lab tests were inconclusive. No one can tell me why Mira had to come into the world the way that she did, or for that matter, why I did too. So I started to ask the same question in a bigger sense. What happens? What happens to 1 in 10 babies and their families? When I first heard Mira might come a little early, my conception of preterm birth was, well, embryonic, even though I had known the basic gist of my own early arrival all my life. As I peered back into my memories of her first months, this subject opened itself up in strange and profound and confusing ways. More questions suggested themselves. The weird intersections that had fluttered by, the science I had half understood, the other families that we had passed in that fog, the astounding fact that babies like Mira are now more than likely to survive. What happened? If you've been pregnant, you probably know the prenatal visit drill, and it goes something like this. Risk of Down syndrome, diet and weight gain, Pitocin and epidurals and C-sections, genetic testing. There are certain topics that come up over and over in routine obstetric visits. Preterm birth is usually not one of them. I remember in particular how much emphasis was put on finding out if my fetus had Down syndrome, since I was going to be 35 when I gave birth, putting me over the line into geriatric. But as a healthy, non-smoking, 35-year-old, middle-income white woman living in Kings County, New York, I had about an 8% chance of a preterm birth. In other words, even without the extra risk indicated by the low Pap A, I was already 29 times more likely to give birth early than I was to have a baby with Down syndrome. Chromosomal conditions like Down syndrome can't be cured, of course, but once they are discovered, there is a decision to be made. Continue the pregnancy or end it. And physicians like to offer medical options. I don't blame them. With preterm birth, this is impossible. There is precious little scientific consensus on why it happens, much less how to prevent it. In many cases, there is nothing much to do but wait, watch, and hope to go full term. It is a phenomenon defined by uncertainty. And to complicate matters further, it is a pregnancy outcome with many different causes, not a single disease or condition. Any true statement about prematurity has at least a dozen caveats. One of the most astonishing facts about preterm birth is just how common it is, how devastating it is to the health of women and babies, and yet how invisible. Premature birth is the leading cause of newborn death in the United States and worldwide. It has surpassed pneumonia as the leading cause of death for children under 5 throughout the world. It is also a leading cause of developmental problems of all kinds, learning disabilities, and chronic conditions like asthma. Prematurity costs the United States about $26 billion per year. And more importantly, it is the cause of untold sorrow and struggle. The American preterm birth rate is 10.02% and rising. That's almost 400,000 premature babies each year, the worst rate in the industrialized world. Worldwide, 15 million babies are born too soon, and about 1 million of them die as a result. The consequences of a preterm birth can follow even the luckiest of families for years, sometimes for entire lives. It is a postpartum anxiety or depression that is too slow to ebb, a lingering vigilance, an alarm that keeps ringing in your head. It is dragging an oxygen tank with you to the playground.